Ruth Turner, Cleveland, May 7. Back to Myrdal, his plan for an ideal reconstruction of the South after the Civil War. You said you would not accept even the guaranteed success of the plan, the compensation to slaveholders for emancipation or to landholders for expropriated land. Is that right?
Well, I said, as I recall, that it was a painful decision to make. And of course, by the token of my experience here in the movement, such assurances, when delivered by certain people, mean little. But given the question as put, I guess I would painfully make the decision to compensate. In other words, there are certain times when I will compromise with an ideal for the sake of another.
Isn't this a little bit like saying, I will compromise with my ideal for the sake of achieving my ideal?
Mm-hmm. It's a real contradiction. In fact, the involvement in the movement in itself presents many such contradictions.
Could you explain that, please?
Yes, I believe we talked about it briefly before. The fact that in the recent school demonstrations at the sites, put in the position of saying that, it's not an exact parallel, no, but there is a compromise of ideal by saying that you're ready to sacrifice human life for the sake of preserving human life. And that was, in a sense, what we had said in the outset, and that's exactly what happened. That is the kind of contradiction in which you find yourself. That the immediate sacrifice is going to bring about something that is that goes beyond the immediate, but in the process you are giving up something valuable.
Some people I have put this Myrdal question to have felt actually insulted by it. Did you feel insulted by it?
No, I'm not insulted by it. I think it raised some very basic questions, the kinds of questions that we grapple with really daily in the movement. Because this is not a cut and dry, black and white. It's a matter of constant adjustment and readjustment, a matter of feeling at home with contradictions. And not too many people do that easily. I don't.
Let me change the topic a little bit. Going back to the question of leadership, in all historical situations of mass movements or revolutionary tendencies, there is a kind of tendency to overreaching. Do you see this process now going on in the problem of Negro leadership, an overreaching process in these bids for power or for policy?
In a sense, yes. I note in particular someone like Malcolm X, who, actually is not really saying anything so very basically different from what we are. He's adding the dimension of the use of violence if all else fails. And in a sense, of course, has an appeal to an audience which is beset with frustrations, as Negroes are.
You were saying that Malcolm X is an example of the overreaching process.
Well, let me say that the solutions he spells out are attractive solutions. They are solutions to which I respond in moments of real depression.
Excuse me. This includes the racial separation as part of the policy, his policy you approve?
No, I'm talking about the solution that he spelled out in Cleveland not too long ago, which was ballots versus bullets, or the ballot or the bullet. Making the point that if the ballot didn't work pretty soon, then the bullet would follow.
Will the bullet work?
Well, let me say that those of us who are involved in organizing a community, at least I feel a heavy responsibility to that community, and I feel that any time I organize around the bullet phase, I'm asking for something that can approach mass extermination. And therefore, it's a much too risky business for me to try to organize anybody around. I think that it is courting disaster.
This is one of those wild, sort of speculative questions. If you could, by an act of will like that, without having to watch the consequences with no pain, exterminate all white citizens of USA, would you do it?
No, I am. I pride myself on being a humanitarian. I am not going to resort to the methods that inhumane people use.
This wouldn't be inhumane. They would die like that without ever knowing it, simultaneously.
Well, you still have human problems left. I don't think that there is any like that solution to the problem of living on Earth with people of different kinds, temperaments, and what have you.
Suppose you could get rid of another hypothetical question. I could stipulate that it all be gone like that, with a flick of the finger. Would you do it?
No, because they will have existed, and you can't wipe the memory or the fact that they had existed out of people's minds. You would have to cope with that for the rest of your life, and I think that would present, as I think Germany is in the process of discovering, some very basic and real questions and problems. Exterminating a people or a group of people doesn't solve anything. It doesn't solve a basic human problem of man having to live with man. And in fact, the very fact that you use that kind of method complicates the problem of living together.
Do you see Mr. Brunson as an example of the overreach in the power bid or the policy bid?
Talking about Brunson, who was involved with Stalin's. I think, getting back to the point we raised before, any effective, and I hate to use the word responsible because it's so misused, but any effective leader, any committed and dedicated leader has got to have his foot with the community at the same time he's maybe a step ahead of them. And if you are not making and taking pains to keep in touch with the community every step along the way, I think you're overreaching them.
What about the kind of touch with the white community? What relations that you really have to that? Is there some problem here too?
You mean in terms of keeping in touch with them? Yes, clearly there is a problem with that. But the fact is that we do have a community to which we respond and which responds to us. We can't expect to bring the whole community along at the same time because we're all at different levels of awareness and different experiential development. So that as long as we're in touch with a community, I feel as though we're still fulfilling our obligation as leaders. If we reach the point where we no longer speak to any and speak for any or with any, then I think we're no longer leaders that I would like to call myself.
Do you distinguish between two kinds of demonstrations, say those of general dissatisfaction and those with specific targets or objectives?
Yeah, I imagine they're different. Yes, they're probably those two different kinds of demonstrations.
Would you say one is legitimate and the other is illegitimate?
No, I would never make that distinction. I think we have to evaluate each demonstration on its own face.
But the random expression of feeling is potentially as useful as the channelized targeted demonstration, is that it?
Let me say, in terms of bringing about change, clearly the constructive and targeted and channeled demonstration aimed at something is perhaps more useful. The random demonstration of feeling, however, may convince in those communities where the power structure or the leaders are not convinced the intensity of the feeling in the general community about these problems.
What do you think of Abraham Lincoln, Miss Turner?
I believe I have always wanted to study the history of and the life of Abraham Lincoln because I believe that unfortunately much of that is passed on about him is not true. I, in fact, have some evidence to that effect, that Lincoln shared in many ways the same prejudices and feelings that his counterparts did.
If he did, how does that affect your feelings about him? and about the march on Washington and the ceremony at his monument.
Well, it means to me that I take a rather different view of such heroes, so-called. I feel that American history has vastly distorted their position, although I think that he was the man at the time to commit a very important historical act. It's not really that relevant how I feel about him personally. Nevertheless, because I'm aware of the distortion that has taken place in American history books generally, I'm sensitive to an overrating of any individual.
What do you think of William Lloyd Garrison?
He's a man who also performed an important historical function, and I have to evaluate him in terms of the function he performed. I have no feelings about him as a man, except that he did a job, he did it well.
What view did you take of the Negro after the Civil War? Do you know that?
Negro after the Civil War? I think in terms of what happened during Reconstruction and the fact that many of them attempted at least to begin to take their part in the community. They were elected to the legislature in some cases.
I'm sorry, I meant Garrison's behavior after the Civil War.
Oh, I'm not qualified to comment on that, Mr. Warren.
What about Robert E. Lee? How do you view him? What kind of an estimate of character would you give us on that?
As I said, I'm not really concerned about my own feelings about a man and his personal abilities and qualities. I'm concerned about the historical role that he played. Lee's role was one that I do not respect.
How do you see his role that you don't respect?
I think he was a leader in an action which was divisive and destructive. I think that his role as a general of the Confederate Army did not work in the best interests of history, and I have to evaluate it as such.
You would like a bad man on the right side of history rather than a good man on the wrong side, is that it?
No, I'm not going to say that.
Well, actually, you just said it.
Well, in this particular case...
Make it general now. Let's don't creep out of it.
Okay. I will say that a bad man who performs an important historical function has to be judged on the basis of the function he performed.
A homicidal maniac at a good cause is more to be admired than a decent idealist who's backing the wrong horse historically. Is that it?
I would say that being not really a historian, but not being a novelist or someone concerned with personalities, I would have to look at it in that way.
Not being concerned with personalities? Well, that means not being concerned with moral values, doesn't it?
Well, I don't, you know, you're making a distinction here that I'm not going to go along with. You're making a distinction between a personality and the role he performs. I think that the personality has an effect on the role he performs. In other words, if it had been a bad man who was in Lincoln's position, he couldn't have performed the role that Lincoln did. The two are very much connected.
Why couldn't he have signed the Declaration, the Emancipation Proclamation, as a war measure? Many bad men went along with it.
Well, let me put it this way. If a Hitler had been sitting in Lincoln's seat, a Hitler with his own particular and peculiar psychological makeup, even in view of the fact that that was the need of the time, Hitler may not have signed it.
He might not, no, but let's assume he would have as a reasonable and effective war measure.
But I'd also have to evaluate the other things that Hitler did. I'm not only talking about a man as he exhibits himself in one particular act. I mean, his time on earth is going to be, he's going to do a lot of things while he's there. But I'm judging the important acts in terms of their effect on history.
What about Thomas Jefferson? How do you feel about him? He was a slaveholder.
He was, but he also performed a very important historical function. I think Thomas Jefferson was a wise man. Again, like Lincoln, he shared many of the prejudices and attitudes of his time. I am concerned primarily at this point, though, with this historical function and the effect it had on the process, realizing that he was one of many who shared the same attitudes.
If he were abandoning moral absolutes and going into matters of historical relativity, aren't we?
Yeah, in a sense we are. Although I'm still not leaving out the role of goodness and badness as it relates to the way a man carries out his historical function.
Most revolutions, all revolutions, I guess, in the past have been directed toward the liquidation of a class or a regime, haven't they?
Yeah, I think so.
If the Negro Revolution is a revolution, what's it liquidating?
I think it's liquidating something quite different. That's why I think this is a quite different kind of revolution. It's liquidating injustices. I don't think those injustices are carried necessarily by a particular class of people in this country. I think, although it is quite true that the wealthy are in control, I don't think the problem is to be solved by liquidating the wealthy. Or let me say the class of people who now sit in the position of power. We're talking here about basic and fundamental changes that have to take place throughout the fabric of our society. That goes beyond class.
It's sometimes said that hate and hope were the great motive powers of social change. What about that in relation to present situation?
Hate and hope? I would say that in a particular movement in which I'm involved, hate doesn't have much of a function. Hope does. Despair does. You're acting on despair with hope. You're acting on frustration with hope. None of us really have time to hate. It's too all-consuming. Similarly, we don't have time to love. Not in any intense personal kind of way.
You mean in the ordinary sense of personal affections?
That's right. Except as they develop through a working relationship. We're talking about another level here, agape, perhaps, using the Christian phrase. Talking about something that really isn't as intense as hate and love, as we usually use those words.
How far do you follow Dr. King, Martin Luther King's view of the philosophy of nonviolence?
I'm not a committed pacifist, nor do I adopt nonviolence as a philosophy of life. I will not carry it no matter what. I feel that I adopt nonviolence presently as a tactical, necessary philosophy, but I will not take it as an ultimate and an absolute.
You think Dr. King's influence in the North is now waning?
I do. I do because I do not feel he addresses himself to the problems, the basic problems that Northerners, in a sense, are in a better position to grapple with than Southerners.
You feel he simply is socially retarded, is that it?
No, I just think he is not politically aware and sensitive.
But this fact being the result of living in a more primitive social order, is that the point?
No, this fact being the result of having to cope with such basic problems that the more important general implications of those problems escape you, not being able to see the forest for the trees. Also, the certain personality makeup, I don't think he's a politician, nor do I think he thinks like one. I think you have to, because we are playing, in a sense, a game of power, and we have to understand the dimensions and the implications of it.
What kind of power does a Negro have to negotiate from? Will you explain that to me, please?
Well, I think he has a certain amount of political power, used in a balance of power kind of way. that he has a great amount of economic power, power of withdrawal, for example. Not in the sense of building an empire, but withdrawing trade from those agencies that don't cooperate. He has a great moral power, because the Negro is the only group which is raising the real moral questions of our time.
Well, now we are back to the element of the struggle in which Dr. King places emphasis, aren't we? The moral power is the same as his theory, isn't it?
Yes, except that I'm talking about it in a different kind of way. I'm not saying that the Negro should be the suffering servant for an American conscience.
Does King say that?
I feel that he does. I feel that we have to also be aware of the fact that the American conscience has become quite deadened by insensitivity and by luxury in many instances. And we have to be prepared to use other methods to reach the American.
Where in the world do you find the conscience, in what country or group of the kind you admire?
Nowhere that I know of. I think perhaps in certain other socialist countries like Sweden, there's something of a better awareness of the general well-being. That may be true of England, I don't know. I haven't been there. It's not true of Germany. I don't know if there's any place in the world, but I don't really make my decisions or implement any ideals on the basis of who else does it.
Some people do, of course, so they create a never-never land and say it's some country X or Y or something, of course. One more question. The tendency of any mass movement or revolutionary movement is to concentrate leadership finally in the man, the one, the leader. Do you see that movement going on now, the movement toward a concentration of leadership, a concentration of power, or the possibility of that?
No, on the contrary, I see a proliferation of power and leadership, and I think that is the real, one of the healthiest signs of this movement, that there are people all over the place who are emerging as leaders. And I think as long as that's the case, then we have something very creative and positive here. I really would dread to see the day when that power and that leadership is located in one person.
Take the opposite situation, where it's totally diffused. Where is that, well, use the hideous word, responsibility located?
Well, I think that we can't have that situation either. I don't think every man is a leader. I think that we have to have leaders and constituencies. I'm saying that we need a lot of constituencies, or we need more than one spokesman for a community. Responsibility lies in accountability to a constituency. It lies in having somebody to whom you return with your decisions.
How does responsibility relate to some ultimate vision of society?
How does it relate to an ultimate vision of society?
A vision of what can be had, your ideal city.
Well, it seems to me that I can best make the example of politics as I'd like to see them. This idea of responsibility, as I've just outlined it, accountability to a group of people. It seems to me that many of the problems of our politics today is that the leaders are not responsible and do not feel responsible to anyone besides themselves and their own interests. I would like to see the kind of society where those who are chosen for leadership are responsible for those who have chosen them and feel responsible to their needs. And I feel that only by doing this do we have anything that approaches a democracy. Only by eliminating that personal, selfish motive that creeps into so many leaders do we establish the kind of society that I think I'll feel happy and secure in.
is the end of the conversation with Miss Ruth Turner, and no more.